If you would make your way to your seats, we're going to have an introduction here very shortly. Please make your way to your seats. My privilege to introduce Dr. William Weinrich, who is our professor of early church history and patristic studies, which makes him especially a notable speaker for this occasion. And he has served on our faculty since 1975. After his bachelor's degree from the University of Oklahoma and his Master of Divinity degree from Concordia Seminary, St. Louis, he did his doctoral studies under the guidance of Bo Reike and Oscar Coleman at the University of Basel. In addition to teaching, Dr. Weinrich has served this seminary very ably as the Dean of Graduate Studies in the past and also as one of my predecessors in the Office of Academic Dean. Through his classroom teaching and publication for almost four decades, Dr. Weinrich has done more to promote an appreciation of the understanding of the early church fathers than anyone else in the history of our Lutheran Church Missouri Synod. Now, I'm saying that as my opinion, but Bill, there aren't a lot of other people in your company with that. But certainly that is one of his great contributions in our own church. His theological acumen and has also been shared with the wider church through his service in the Missouri Synod's Commission on Theology and Church Relations, and also his service as the third vice president and the fifth vice president of our synod in the past years. More importantly for this audience on this occasion, he has not only taught the early church fathers for many years, but has also been an active translator of their writings, editing the Ancient Christian Commentary volume on Revelation for InterVarsity Press, as well as translating and editing two ancient Greek commentaries, four ancient Latin commentaries for that same press, InterVarsity. He's currently writing the Concordia commentary on the Gospel of John, and I'm certain that more than a few quotes from the early fathers will be part of that volume. His paper today, The Virtuous Anger of God, Lactantius de Iuric Dei, in conversation with the philosophy of the third century, is his title. So join me in welcoming Professor Weinrich to the podium.
Well, thank you, Chuck, for those kind words. And it is kind of true that if you live long enough, you're kind of alone, at least in some things. So I think any benefit I have from those kind remarks is only because I'm the oldest one to whom you might refer. According to the Apostle Paul, things in heaven and upon earth were created in Christ, those things visible as well as invisible. All things were created through him and unto him. In view of such an all-encompassing conviction, early Christians could not escape the necessity of giving an account of the world and of the life of man. To be sure, early Christian thought interpreted the hopes and aspirations of Israel in terms of the revelation in Jesus. However, claims concerning the divine status of this man required as well the task of interpreting the hopes and aspirations of humanity as a whole, as illuminated and clarified in the Christian revelation. For this task, Christian thought could not remain within the conceptual limits of Old Testament prophecy. Christian thought had to engage the thinking of the Gentile pagan world, and this it did with a passion and an intellectual vigor, and with a measure of success that remains one of the great achievements in the history of the last two millennia. And the early church did so also with a great amount of confidence. As Clement of Alexandria famously put it, if the Hebrew scriptures were a pedagogue unto Christ for the Jew, then the philosophy of the Greeks was a pedagogy unto Christ for the Gentile. By the way, there are copies of quite a number of quotes. If you don't have one, maybe just raise your hand, and I think somebody is in the back to give you one. From very early on, Christians were in direct conversation with philosophical ideas current in Roman society. No conversation was more pervasive and fundamental to the confrontation of biblical ideas with classical thinking than was that concerning providence and the role of the passions in the moral life. Here the claims of Epicurus and the Stoa assumed center stage. Both in their own ways claimed that true happiness was attainable only when the disorderly impulses of the passions were restrained or even transcended. The wise person attains to virtue, hence to wisdom and happiness, only in the tranquility of the soul. Such views were powerful, often dominant, in the intellectual circles of Roman philosophical society. And in their desire to present Christianity as the true philosophy, some Christian thinkers found these views irresistible. Clement of Alexandria, for example, claimed that Christ was an intellectual being, and as such was entirely impassible, inaccessible to any movement of feeling, either to pleasure or to pain. The Christian, therefore, was called to become a Gnostic or a perfect man, similar to the teacher in his impassibility and for whom such passions as anger, to take that passion most relevant to our discussion, are meaningless and are to be eradicated from the soul. "The good man is not angry," said Clement, "for there is nothing to move him to anger, seeing that he ever loves God and is entirely turned toward him only, and therefore hates none of God's creatures." Early Christian martyr texts as well were hardly free from Stoic understandings of the passion of the soul, even of that supreme moment of virtue when the martyr gave freely his life to God. For example, in the martyrdom of Apollonius, the martyr testifies before the governor that Jesus had gained a great reputation for virtue, and he taught us to put a stop to anger, to moderate our desires, and to conquer our pleasures, to root out our grief. We can recognize in these four passions the common Stoic listing of the primary passions which must be eradicated if the life of virtue is to be achieved. Yet, as Robert Wilkin has noted concerning the views of Clement expressed above, even when Christian thinkers defended apatheia, divine or human impassibility, as the goal of life, they could hardly avoid the language of love. In the passage quoted, Clement thinks of love as that state which is devoid of the passions. Love, he writes, is a relation of affection from which the affinity to the impassible God arises. As Wilkin notes, Clement's philosophical instincts pulled him in one direction, while the language and logic of the scriptures pulled him in another. The same is true of the martyrdom of Apollonius. In the very catalog of Jesus' teachings, which list the passions to be rooted out or moderated, Apollonius lists as well Jesus' teaching to intensify love. Indeed, biblical concept rendered the uncritical acceptance of the Stoic theory of the passions increasingly difficult. After all, the scriptures commonly depicted God himself as quite filled with them, including the passion of wrath. The story of the wilderness wanderings of Israel is narrated as a repeated provoking of God to wrath. Remember and do not forget how you provoked the Lord your God to wrath in the wilderness, writes Moses. Among those who on the basis of Scripture began to question the philosophical understanding of the moral life was Lucius Caecilius Firmianus Lactantius. We know little of this man, and what we know comes largely from Jerome and his statements you have before you. Born into paganism in North Africa, Lactantius was a pupil of the Christian apologist Arnobius of Sicca, and like him, a convert to Christianity. The excellence of Lactantius's Latin earned for him the epithet of the Christian Cicero, and he was summoned by the emperor Diocletian to teach rhetoric in Nicomedia. Following the imperial edict of 303, however, which prohibited Christians from public office, Lactantius was forced to resign his post and experience personally exile and persecution for more than a decade. In 317, however, Lactantius received the patronage of Constantine and became the tutor of Crispus Caesar, the son of Constantine, in Gaul. He apparently retained that position for the rest of his life, dying circa 326. With the exception of his work De Officio Dei, all of his works were written under the patronage of Constantine. Like Minucius Felix before him, Lactantius emphasizes the doctrine of providence as the chief connection between Stoicism and Christian faith. However, unlike Minucius Felix, Lactantius does not write to recommend Christianity by showing the affinities between Stoicism and the Christian truth. He writes rather to recommend Christianity as that which is superior to pagan philosophy. He emphasizes the limits and deficiencies of philosophy as a source of truth. As Lactantius notes at the beginning of De Ira Dei, the philosophers are destitute of the teaching of God and therefore have imagined that the nature of things can be ascertained by conjecture. Yet Lactantius does not argue by the explicit use of scripture quotation. As a debater, Lactantius subscribes to the principle that it is pointless to argue from an authority unless the authorities involved are recognized as such by one's opponent. And so, addressing himself to a pagan audience, he confines himself to pagan sources. Nonetheless, as we shall note, Lactantius's response to Epicurean and Stoic theories of the passions, especially that of anger, does not involve a mere adjustment to the philosophical idea, but a radical reformulation and appreciation of the role of the passions for the life of virtue on the basis of biblical ideas. The Stoics spoke of four principal passions: desire, joy, fear, distress, or sorrow. These passions are irrational disturbances of the soul and occasion what can rightly be called a disease or sickness. Cicero puts it this way: "For as all disturbance is a movement of the soul, either destitute of reason or contemptuous of it, or disobedient to reason, and as such, a movement is provoked in two ways, either by an idea of good or by an idea of evil." And so we have four disturbances: 2, proceeding from an idea of good, namely desire or joy, and 2, by the idea of evil, namely fear or distress. These passions are not natural to man, but arise in him by unnecessary and harmful judgments by which we form concerning circumstances which are in themselves neither good nor evil, but may be regarded as desirable or no. Passions are therefore grounded in how we evaluate and judge the circumstances of our lives which confront us. For example, if I judge that I have been offended or harmed, and that this offense is bad for me, the feeling of anger in me may be regarded as appropriate and justified. However, my feeling of anger only makes sense when I judge that I have been slighted and that it is bad for me. The passion of anger can be avoided if I withhold such judgment, namely that I have been slighted or harmed. That is, that anything bad has happened to me. And this is the basis for the Stoic claim that the life of virtue is one of indifference to the world. The passions arise when something which can only properly be preferred or not preferred are accounted as intrinsically good or evil. The life of virtue regards all passions as inappropriate. And therefore, because they can only occur in those circumstances when one has given an attachment to something that is not in itself a good, or when one regards as harm what is in itself not in fact a harm, then the passions may be seen as irrational and disturbances of the soul. That is why Cicero asserted that all passions are against reason or disobedient to it. To attach oneself to what is essentially indifferent, or to order one's life to it, this is irrational. And although contrary to reason, yet the passions are in our control, and for this reason, as the Stoics constantly exhort, they must be rooted out, extirpated, to use the preferred term of the Stoa. It is not enough to moderate the passions or to control them, as Aristotle might exhort. They must be wiped off utterly from the human soul. Indeed, this is, according to Seneca, the fundamental difference between the Stoa and the Peripatetics. We expel the affections while they temper them. Complete apathy is therefore the ideal that man should strive for. Indifference to the world lies at the basis of virtue, and the life lived in virtue is the highest good. Now, of all the passions, anger is the most dangerous and uncontrollable. To warn against any positive evaluation of this passion, Seneca dedicated a special treatise, De Ira, in 3 books. Anger, he writes, is the most hideous and rabid of all the emotions. While the other passions may have something of peace or calm in them, this passion is wholly violent and has its being in an onrush of resentment, raging with a most inhuman lust for weapons, blood, and punishment. Anger is devoid of self-control, forgetful of decency, unmindful of obligations, persistent and diligent in what it begins, that is, it is difficult to control once unleashed. It is closed to reason and counsel, agitated by trifling causes, unfit to discern what is just and true. Indeed, argues Seneca, anger in itself has nothing useful. In no way does it contribute to the life of virtue. And with this claim, Seneca opposes Aristotle. Using a military analogy, Aristotle had said that anger is necessary, and no battle can be won without it. Unless anger fills the mind and fires the soul, nothing can be achieved in war. Anger, however, must serve, not as a leader, but as the common soldier, says Aristotle. While, therefore, according to Aristotle, anger may not assume the role of the guiding principle, it is necessary to provide the impetus for the action of the soul. To this, Seneca replies, quod est falsum. You all understand that. This is not true. For the chief characteristic of anger and its proper quality, says Seneca, is a willful obstinacy, a contumacia. At every point, anger resists and opposes any attempt to guide or rule it. If, therefore, anger suffers any limitation to be imposed upon it, it must be called by some other name, for it has ceased to be anger. For I, says Seneca, understand anger to be nothing other than unbridled and ungovernable. Anger, therefore, is not to be numbered among those things which aid or assist the soul. Virtue, rather, is self-sufficient and never requires the assistance of vice. Should the need for violent movement of the soul occur, the soul does not become angry, says Seneca, but rises up and, according to its estimate of the need, this idea of judgment, is either moved to anger or caused to relax. And here is the classic notion, as I said, of judgment, which stands essentially indifferent toward the circumstances confronting the soul. Significantly, Seneca offers his own military analogy. While Aristotle had likened anger to the common soldier, that is, to one who has reason and is moved to action, Seneca likens the soul to an engine of war, which hurls arrows. It is the operator who controls the tension by which the arrows are hurled. Nature has given to us an adequate equipment in reason, says Seneca, and there is no need for any other instrument of war. This is the weapon, reason, which nature has bestowed. It is strong, it endures, it is obedient, it is not double-edged or capable of being turned against its owner. Reason is all-sufficient in itself, serving not merely for counsel, but for action as well. Reason needs nothing to move it. Thus, Seneca concludes, reason will never call to its aid blind and violent impulses over which itself will have no control, which it can never crush except by setting against them equally powerful and similar impulses, as fear against anger, or anger against sloth, or greed against fear. Indeed, even should one be confronted by an evil, such as the murder of his father or the rape of his mother, a good man will not be angry. To feel anger on behalf of loved ones is the mark of weakness, writes Seneca. Rather, for a man to stand forth as the defender of parents, children, friends, and fellow citizens, led merely by his sense of duty, acting willingly, using judgment, using foresight, moved neither by impulse or fury, this, he says, is noble and becoming. For Lactantius, such thinking was not only wrong, it was dangerous. Lactantius begins his own treatise on the anger of God with the following words. I have often observed Donatus. We don't quite know who this Donatus is, but in one passage he refers to 9 different occasions in which Donatus had been persecuted. I have often observed Donatus that many persons hold this opinion, which some philosophers also have maintained, that God is not subject to anger, since he is of a divine nature, and so is altogether beneficent, or that God takes no notice of us at all. This view, says Lactantius, is an error which is very great, maximus, for it tends to overthrow the condition of human life. The world for Lactantius is not a mere set of circumstances, a state of affairs that man may confront placidly with his judgment, nor is the world a place in which man may be indifferent. The world is in the first instance the arena of divine providential activity, an activity which not only preserves order and harmony, but guides and leads man towards his proper destiny. Thus, in the world, man is at every point confronted by a God who is moved, that is, who acts. The failing of the Stoic teaching was that it could not give an account for the movement of God, what it is that occasions God's activity, nor could it account for what moves the human soul to act. On the Stoic view, the moral life of man was otios, a life made blessed and happy in the absence of fundamental commitments, a life most happy where most indifferent to the world. But a deus otiosus is no God at all, and a homo otiosus is the very inverse of what it means to be human. And so, to summarize, the Stoic regarded the highest good, the summum bonum, to be the life of virtue, understood as life in accordance with nature. The virtuous life was an end in itself and possesses happiness when free from the cares of attachments. Moreover, the Stoics affirmed that the life of virtue was in our power. Through foresight and judgment, we can assume the posture of virtue and indifference to the realities of life. And finally, the Stoics affirm that the life of happiness can be attained in this life on earth. In opposition to this perspective of man in the world, Lactantius makes several claims to which now we must pay some attention. How did Lactantius respond to this Stoic perspective? First of all, to the claim that the life of virtue was in our power, Lactantius makes a counter-Christian claim. We are not so arrogant as to boast that the truth is comprehended by our mental power. Rather, we follow the teaching of God, who alone is able to know and to reveal secret things. The philosophers are, however, destitute of this teaching, and so imagine that they can know the nature of things by conjecture. But, he says, this is quite impossible. Why? because the mind of man, enclosed in the dark abode of the body, is far removed from the perception of truth. And in this, the divine nature differs from the human, that ignorance is the property of the good of the human, while knowledge is the property of the divine nature. That a person might indifferently see what is good and what is evil, and have the power to choose the right path, is for Christian Lactantius a fantasy. Humankind requires, he says, some light to dispel the darkness by which the reflection of man is overspread, since while we live in mortal flesh, we are unable to perceive through our sense. That light, which is necessary for the perception of truth, is God. The light of the human mind is God. And he who has known and admitted him into his breast, that is the Christian, will acknowledge the mystery of the truth with an enlightened mind. Now here we can see the effects of the doctrine of the fall into sin on Christian epistemology, at least as that is represented by Lactantius. The mind of man has no intrinsic light of its own, no natural power of moral discernment that is free of taint. In short, as Lactantius says, there is no human wisdom. The moral life of man must be guided by a teaching which is not known naturally, but which is from God, who alone knows and reveals secret things. The Christian revelation through the teachings of Jesus is required for the life of virtue. Lactantius introduces his presentation on the anger of God by listing three steps by which one, as he says, ascends to the abode of truth. The third and last of these is to know God's minister and messenger, whom as his ambassador he sent to earth, so that by his teaching, being freed from the error by which we are held entangled, and formed to the worship of the true God, we might learn righteousness. Secondly, man is then entangled by error. That the fall of Adam involved the human race in a downward movement of the soul toward every manner of vice is a common theme in patristic literature. The theme is classically represented in the Wisdom of Solomon, as well as in the first chapter of Paul's letter to the Romans. Lactantius reflects as well this idea in opposing the notion that man's reason is by nature free from the passions, and so is a neutral judge in determining man's response to the vicissitudes of life. Rather, says Lactantius, the passions are implanted in man by God and can neither be taken away, as the Stoics claimed, nor can they be moderated, as the Peripatetics say. Indeed, it is neither good nor right that the passions should be moderated, since they are good by nature, and so we ought to use them to their very fullest extent. And so man is, by nature, filled with passions. He's a creature in motion. He lives, as it were, in and through the passions and relates to the world and to his neighbor through them. Implanted in man's nature, the passions have, as Lactantius puts it, a sure and great influence. Apart from the teaching of God and the restraint of God, however, that sure and great influence goes only one way. Man has, says Lactantius, lost his reason. And unless God, who cannot be deceived, shall restrain our desires, we shall most certainly live wickedly and impiously. Lactantius extends the notion of providence to include then not only divine oversight of the natural harmonies, but also to include God's care for the truth. Religion, religio, and justice are also the objects of divine providence. Here's a quote that you have on your handout. Because if religion and justice are taken away, having lost our reason, we either descend to the senselessness of the herds or to the savageness of the beasts, indeed even more, since the beasts spare animals of their own kind. But what will be more savage, what more unmerciful than man? If the fear of a superior being taken away, he shall be able either to escape the notice of or to despite the might of the laws. It is therefore the fear of God only which guards the mutual society of man, by which life itself is sustained, protected, and governed. But that fear is taken away if man is persuaded that God is without anger. Biblical realism concerning the power of sin does not allow Lactantius to have confidence in the Epicurean denial of divine providence or in the Stoic account of virtue in apatheia. Man must be restrained if man is to be virtuous. And this restraint exists for the sake of religion, for the sake of wisdom, and for the sake of justice. Thirdly, the criterion for judging the passions exists in their use. Toward what end, to what purpose are the passions to be employed? To answer this question, Lactantius appeals to the biblical idea that man was created for an end that lies not in himself but in God. God made the world for the sake of man, and man is the sole object of God's care. However, God also made man for the sake of himself, so that man might be, as it were, a priest in a divine temple, a spectator of his works and of heavenly objects. And for this reason, God gave to man only reason, prudence, language, namely those powers which enable man to know God and to declare his majesty. All other created things were placed under man's control, even as man is under God's. This arrangement of mutual gifts and obligations is what Lactantius means by the word religion. God is the providential creator of man, and man as the priestly creature of God exists within this relationship, within this arrangement, and their duties towards one another are defined by this arrangement. If God, therefore, another one of the quotes, designed man to be a worshiper of himself, and on this account gave to him such honor that he might rule over all things, it is plainly most just that he should worship God, who bestowed upon him such gifts and love man, who is united with us in the participation of the divine justice. For it is not right that a worshiper of God should be injured by a worshiper of God. And from this it is understood that man was made for the sake of religion and justice. And if this is most true, it follows that God will have all men to be just, That is, to have God and man as objects of their affection, to honor God in truth as a father, and to love man as a brother. For in these two things, the whole of justice is comprised. But he who fails to either acknowledge God or acts injuriously toward man lives unjustly and contrary to his nature, and in this manner disturbs the divine institution and law. This is an interesting and important passage, for it shows on the one hand that Lactantius is redefining the life of virtue in terms of the biblical claim that the law of God is fulfilled in the twofold commandment of love for God and man. On the other hand, it reveals the context within which Lactantius appeals to the necessity of the divine anger. And so fourthly, God and man live together in an arrangement within which God wills to give to man goodness and benefit, and within which God, man is to be just, that is, to return to God proper homage and worship, and to return to men love as to a brother. Yet, as we have noted, Lactantius cannot accept the placid apatheia of Stoic doctrine. Man moves, and as one who has lost his reason, man moves necessarily towards senselessness and savagery. And in such a circumstance, if God is to uphold the wisdom and justice of the original system, he must be moved to act in such a manner as to restrain man from evil and to constrain him towards the good. What moves God to such action is his anger. For that God is moved and indignant when unjust actions are done, not only the common advantage, but even reason itself and truth persuade us. It's not quite clear what he means by truth here, although I think it must mean the revelation of Jesus' teaching. The providence of God, therefore, entails and necessitates the use of divine anger, for unless God shall restrain our desires, we shall live wickedly and impiously. Therefore, that our action should be viewed by God, seen by him, pertains not only to the usefulness of common life, but even to the truth. Thus, Lactantius can even assert that anger is an expression of reason. By virtue of divine anger, man is restrained or constrained through fear. Unlike the Stoic, for whom fear was judged a weakness, for Lactantius, the fear of divine anger is an expression of virtue, for it brings wayward man again into conformity with that wisdom and justice for which man was created. What will be more savage, what more unmerciful than man if the fear of a superior being is taken away? Contrary to philosophical definitions of anger, Lactantius then gives his own. He quotes Seneca explicitly. Anger is the desire of avenging an injury. Others, such as Posidonius and Aristotle, have similar definitions. But such anger, says Lactantius, is unjust anger. Anger unjustly used, for it rushes towards rage and vengeance. This anger does not exist in God because God cannot be injured. Rather, divine anger is just because God is good, and it is natural for one who is good to be moved and incited at the faults of others. And so the right definition of anger is this: anger is an emotion of the mind arousing itself for the restraint of fault. Thus, the anger which relates to the correction of vices ought not to be taken away from man and not to be said to be absent from God, because it is both serviceable for the affairs of men and necessary for it. Fifthly, in a remarkable statement, Lactantius says that favor, gratia, and anger, ira, and mercy, miseratio, have their substance or material in God, and that rightly does that highest and most singular power employ these for the preservation of the world. His use of favor, gratia, corresponds to the classical use of the term, which refers to those mutual obligations which are required by the arrangements of family, friendship, or society. To be ungrateful was to refuse services to those who have rendered a prior service. What is Christian, however, is Lactantius's mention of mercy or pity as the cause or the occasion of favor. God is neither so unmerciful nor a despiser of the human race so as to refuse assistance to those who are in distress. In such circumstances, God has an occasion for the exercise of mercy. And this is true not only for those who appease and entreat God when evils befall them, but it is especially true as well for those many, plurimi, who are persuaded that justice is pleasing to God, who worship Him, and with continual prayers and repeated vows offer gifts and sacrifices, whose name is attended with praise, and who strive with just and good works to gain His favor. That is the Christian. On the other hand, there is a cause of anger in God when others pollute by lust, commit perjury, neglect the laws, and even ignore God. It may be said that Lactantius has not achieved the full evangelical insight that divine mercy and grace is toward the unrighteous sinner. He is not fully freed from the classical view which assumes that favor assumes a prior arrangement of mutual service and obligation. The pious pagan who entreats God, and especially the Christian, who with continual prayer and good works appeals to God's beneficence, may expect the divine mercy. Nonetheless, one may at least notice the influence of Christian teaching upon the classical view, so explicitly stated by Seneca, that mercy for the distressed is a weakness and is at all costs to be avoided. Finally, let me make two concluding observations to place Lactantius' observation and his views into historical context. He wrote at a time when the persecution of Diocletian was still fresh in memory, and when the ascendancy of Constantine promised but had not yet secured Christian faith. Lactantius is not a speculative thinker. He reflects on the question of divine anger in the context of the life of man and in the context of the Christian, such as it in fact is lived in the world. The anger of God is thus employed in the final analysis in view of the end of man, that is, in view of man's destiny, which is that of immortality. Virtue cannot be achieved in this world to any perfection at all, against the Stoic view that it could. God's anger is not employed autonomously either. It is employed in the service of God's mercy and in the service of His providential intent that man come to immortality. Thus, God's anger is moderated and must be at times moderated, lest man, who is frail and subject to sin, simply fall under the final judgment of the divine wrath. For no one, Lactantius says, is able to escape divine wrath. Therefore, unless God were indulgent to this necessity, perhaps only few would live. And so on this account, God is most patient, which is also a perfect virtue in God, and restrains his anger. And as demonstration of the beneficial effects of divine indulgence, Lactantius refers to the spread of virtue through Christian teaching. How many persons, having been sinners, have afterward become righteous? From being injurious, have become good. From being wicked, have become temperate. How many were in early life base, condemned by the judgment of all, and who afterwards have turned out to be praiseworthy? But it is plain that this could not happen if divine punishment followed every offense. Thus God controls his anger and is not ruled by it. It is moderated by his misericordia and his gratia, by his will that man created for immortality, in fact, achieve it. And for this reason, says Lactantius, God does not immediately punish everyone who is guilty, that man may have the opportunity of coming to a right mind and correct himself. And so the issue of divine anger is here removed from any purely philosophical interest and placed at the service of the Christian appeal for repentance and conversion. And finally, virtue can be lived only in the face of vice and evil. God's anger, as we have noted, serves to keep man in the way of virtue by restraining his propensity towards vice. And so the greatest fear is the greatest virtue. This belief explains the place of the Christian in the world as one of poverty, lowliness, and persecution. For virtue is the enduring of evils, he says. Thus the man born to justice will avoid pleasure, despise riches. He will injure no one, and if he suffers, he will not retaliate. And so if there be anyone who would compel the Christian to depart from God, he will not refuse torture or even death. And so it will come to pass that he must necessarily live in poverty, lowliness, and even in insult and torture. According to Lactantius, the anger of God is necessary and virtuous. In the face of a fallen world, it moves God to restrain human sin and so serves to rectify man's own will. Apart from the anger of God, man would simply remain sinner. And remaining sinner, the good and gracious intent of God that man gain immortality would be thwarted. If we judge Lactantius here and there deficient of the full clarity of the gospel, yet at least we might thank him for giving place to God's restraining and condemning work for the sake of man. And in the face of opposition, such as that from Seneca and Cicero, that, I submit, was no mean achievement. Thank you very much.
I think rather than endure the virtuous anger of our dean of chapel, I'll dismiss. But just to make sure everyone knows their schedule, there is after Vespers, which starts in just a few minutes, there is the Gemütlichkeit from 6 to 6:40, and then we'll be gathering after that at the dining hall. I think the Gemütlichkeit will be, if you move from the chapel right over to across the pathway to the upper plaza of the library, it'll be in the commons. Okay, very good. So after chapel, move to the student commons, and from there into the dining hall at 6:45. Thank you.